just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, August 28th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Students and faculty organize against budget cuts at Cal State Northridge. A journalist just returned from Afghanistan reports of fraud and disillusionment over the election. And Food Fight, a documentary about changing the way we think about food.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. It's raining ash outside my home in Pasadena. There are three fires going on in Southern California right now. A wildfire has consumed about 1,800 acres above Azusa and Glendora. Another one above La Cañada Flint Ridge has burned about 350 acres. The third fire is threatening the Palos Verdes Peninsula south of Los Angeles. Fire crews have made headway on the larger fire, which started on Tuesday. It was 45% contained as of last night, according to the LA Times. The La Cañada fire was 10% contained last night. It may be a week more before both are contained. About 500 homes in La Cañada have been evacuated, a total of 1,500 homes over the three fires. The heat and very low humidity have fueled the fires, and any strong winds could worsen the situation. KPFK will continue to update you throughout the day. Results from last week's presidential election in Afghanistan continue to trickle in, with 17% of polling stations reporting from across the nation. Incumbent President Hamid Karzai leads his main opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, with 43% to 34%. Karzai needs 51% of the vote to avoid a runoff. President Obama has lauded the election as a success, calling it, quote, an important step forward in the Afghan people's efforts to take control of their future. But on the ground in Afghanistan, sentiment is not as optimistic. Reports indicate that Karzai forged alliances with influential regional warlords who pressured large blocks of their followers to vote for him in exchange for promises of newly carved out provinces. Other reports of voter fraud include the distribution of multiple voting cards to single individuals, including to children ineligible to vote, the registration of women without their consent, and the sale of falsified registration cards. Voter turnout, especially among Afghan women, has been reported to be much lower this election than in the 2004 and 2005 elections, partly due to Taliban threats of violence. With limited rights in many parts of the country, many women were unable to vote last week, as at least 650 polling stations for women did not even open. Large numbers of Afghanistan's working poor also remained marginalized at the polls. Reports reveal that journalists who defied the government ban on reporting election violence were beaten and arrested by Afghan law enforcement. The Taliban also threatened journalists with death for covering the election. I spoke recently with Tony Cross, a reporter for Radio France International's English language website, rfienglish.com. He was in Afghanistan, in Kabul in particular, during the elections, and he joins me for a conversation.
Where were you in Afghanistan? How long were you there, and what sorts of folks did you talk to?
I was there for about 10 days. I was in Kabul exclusively. The management of Radio France International actually forbade me to go outside of Kabul for security reasons, although the city was not all that safe, as it turned out on the day. And who I talked to was quite a range of people. I tried to talk to ordinary people on the streets. I was particularly moved myself by a group of people who'd come from another province to work in Kabul, who weren't going to vote because they lived in a brickyard where they hoped to get work in tents, and they couldn't see that the politicians, or for that matter the Taliban, had their interests in mind. They had no; they were completely excluded from the political process. To two of the election candidates. Ramzan Bacha Dost, a clean government campaigner, if you like, who I personally find very interesting, and Abdullah Abdullah, the main opponent, the leading opponent of Hamid Karzai, who claims that he's won the election.
Now, Abdullah Abdullah is the head of the Northern Alliance, and he had a lot of folks that were voting for him, some would say along ethnic lines. How much popularity do you think he has in the country, real popularity, as opposed to people sort of either voting their ethnicity or voting out of intimidation or fear?
It's difficult for me to say countrywide, because as I say, I only went to Kabul.
Sure.
And it appears that Abdullah's main support comes from the north, that is to say mainly from Tajik areas. He himself is actually half Tajik, half Pashtun, so he has a fairly good argument that he doesn't have just ethnic support. But in reality, the impression I get from reports and from people I've talked to is that he is seen by Tajiks, they're the second largest ethnic group after the Pashtuns, who overwhelmingly voted for Hamid Karzai, the incumbent, that most of Abdullah's support, I think, came from Tajiks and maybe from other ethnic groups, hoping to break the very traditional domination of politics and of the state by the Pashtuns, which in theory Hamid Karzai has broken with, but in reality he has to do a lot of pandering to the Pashtun, his Pashtun base. There are reports of intimidation by virtually everybody except for Ramzan Bashar Dost. There are reports of corruption by virtually everybody except for Ramzan Bashar Dost. There are certainly cases of people in the north putting pressure on people to support Abdullah Abdullah. And most of an Afghan election is decided not on the voting day, it's decided by which particular influential people you've won, the candidate has won the support of, and then those influential people in general can deliver the votes of their ethnic group, their province, their village, and so on, up and down the scale.
So, Tony, you've just described how the elections have been viewed by those who are running, and some here in the mainstream media in the U.S. have said, well, maybe this means Afghans just aren't ready for democracy. But talk about the ordinary Afghans that you spoke to who you said it really didn't feel like the election was accessible to them. How did they view the notion of democracy and those in power?
Well, I'd like to start by contrasting it to previous elections, because in the first presidential election in 2004, people were delighted to have the vote, and there was, I think, 70% participation. Already in 2005, for the legislative elections, participation was down to 51%, and although the Election Commission claims that that has kept up in this election, I think that virtually everybody agrees, apart from them, that it was much lower this time. So Afghans are quite happy to participate in a process which will genuinely give them control over their lives. But I think that a great many of them aren't convinced that this process gives them control over their lives. There were two problems, of course, two main problems for participation in this election. The first was the fact that the Taliban said they were quite ready to kill people who took part, and in the south, where they're strong, that was a very persuasive argument. I think it also may well have reduced participation in Kabul as well. There were rocket attacks on Kabul, there were bomb attacks on the day, and there was a bank job the day before, which was claimed by the Taliban, and there was a shootout on the day itself between the police and armed Taliban fighters. So that was one factor. The other factor is this this feeling of exclusion from the electoral process by the poor, and the feeling that the whole thing is decided by warlords, by the rich and the powerful, by those people who are profiting from the drugs trade, above the head of ordinary people. The other thing I would add, if I can go on just a little bit more, is that another problem with this process is that it's all been imposed from outside, and so it's an imitation of the American electoral process. It's not an iron rule of democracy that you directly elect the president. Lots of countries don't do that and haven't done that historically, but now it's become almost a test for democracy. It's not an iron rule for democracy that you have exactly the parliamentary form that has been imposed on Afghanistan from outside. And Afghanistan does have other traditional means of discussing and developing means of rule in the areas, which the Jirga, which are very far from perfect in particular because they exclude women. But I would have thought if democracy were to develop in an Afghan way, they would build on that tradition rather than just taking very quickly an imprint from outside. So inevitably, I think there's a certain feeling of alienation from that.
I'm speaking with Tony Cross, a reporter with Radio France International's English language website. You can read his reports from Afghanistan at rfienglish.com. We'll link to it from our site later today as well. Let's talk about women. You just mentioned that, and there was some attention being paid to women's accessibility of the vote here in the U.S. What were some of the concerns that women had during the election, and did they manage to, you think, have as much access to the vote as men?
No, I don't think they did. I think that I myself didn't see this, but certainly, for example, a team of Asian observers who in general gave the, whom I spoke to, who in general gave the election a relatively clean bill of health, said that there were many, many cases of men turning up with women's voters' cards, their wives, their daughters, their sisters, and demanding to be able to vote for all the women in their household. There were many cases of women turning up to the to vote and voting as their men told them to do so. This is a cultural question in Afghanistan, as in many other countries, and it's a genuine problem, on top of which in some areas, I think you may find that it would have been disapproved of that women went to vote.
But didn't women have more presence and more voter turnout in the past two elections?
Yes, absolutely. I think it went up and it went down again. I think that there were steps forward and that there has been steps back. Some women I spoke to in Kabul said things are a lot better now in Kabul, but in the provinces, in the villages, there's been no improvement in women's situation.
In your reports, you talked to one woman who told you that the main question for women in this election is that women should have the same rights as men. We don't often hear about what women themselves want, at least here in the United States. How common do you think that sentiment was of hers?
I think that that is to be brutally frank, I think that that is a preoccupation of the Kabuli middle class more than women in the villages. However, I can't really say that for sure because it's even difficult for a male reporter to talk to most women in Afghanistan. I think that for many Afghan women, it's not a matter of frustration about not having their rights. In many cases, particularly in rural areas, it may even be the case that they're not conscious of the fact that there are rights that they could have and that they don't.
So it's a situation, you think, where poverty is so great that people are more concerned with the day-to-day survival?
It's poverty and it's cultural issues. But I don't think I should go too far on this because, as I say, as a man, it's difficult for me to talk to Afghan women, particularly the Afghan women who don't have a voice.
Sure. Let's talk about journalists. There was a media ban that the central government put out on journalists providing any kind of negative coverage of the elections. But then on the other side, the journalists in Afghanistan were also threatened by the Taliban for putting positive spin on the elections. So they were caught between these two in this very difficult space. How did journalists manage to navigate these threats during the election?
Well, with difficulty, I think we have to have to say. On election day, many of them were beaten, others were threatened and intimidated. On the one hand, they were threatened with death sometimes by the Taliban if they didn't cover things their way. On the other hand, the government put out a ban on reporting security issues on the day. And, of course, there was also pressure in many regions from warlords, from provincial bigwigs to do as they said and to report things as they said, which might fall into many different camps in the various regions. On the day in Kabul itself, there was a shootout between the Taliban and the police, and journalists who turned up were actually beaten, several of them arrested by the police to enforce this ban on in a very effective manner, to this ban on reporting security issues. Government stations, TV and radio, tended to accept the ban. Private ones in general defied it, and they were courageous enough to do that. Similarly, in the provinces, there was pressure from Taliban and, as I say, from influential people in the provinces. Again, very courageously, some journalists went out and reported what was happening, reported rocket attacks, reported jiggery-pokery at the polling booths.
I'm speaking with Tony Cross, a reporter with Radio France International's English language website, rfienglish.com, and he has just returned from Afghanistan in the aftermath of the election. Tony, did you see any U.S. military presence, even though you were in Kabul?
Oh, you can't miss the U.S. military presence. On the voting, on the day of voting, they were not present on the streets. It was entirely run by the Afghan police. Very tight security, but run by the Afghan police. But you ride around Kabul, and particularly you go down the Jalalabad Road, where the day before a bomb went off, and continually you see convoys of international military vehicles. You have them coming up behind you and loudspeakers blaring at you, telling you to get out of the way. Huge convoys of armored cars and personnel carriers bullying their way along the main roads.
So let's finally talk about the election itself and the results that are supposed to be announced in September. From having been there during the elections, and I'm sure all of the widespread voting fraud that you saw and you heard about, the votes that were cast itself can be questioned, but now it's the counting phase, and preliminary results show that the incumbent Karzai is ahead of Abdullah Abdullah by a little bit, about the amount that some folks predicted. What is your hope in terms of how this election turns out, or what do you think are the prospects for this election, and do you think that there's going to be a lot of questions on even who counts the votes?
Well, I'm personally surprised by the fact that the preliminary results which were announced seem to imply that they're going to go to a second round, because I had the very strong feeling that the Karzai camp was going to make sure that it was solved on the first round. They announced victory almost as soon as the vote had taken place. The Independent Election Commission, which is vetoed by the government, so independent is a stretching of the definition, really. The Independent Election Commission claimed that the turnout was the same as in 1994. Now, virtually nobody believed that. Certainly, those of us who watched the election in Kabul certainly saw a much lower turnout in 2004 and in 2005. So it was very difficult to believe that. All reports from the south showed that it was very low indeed, the turnout in the south. Abdullah chose to believe that turnout because he said, oh, well, that's because everybody voted for me in the north. But I think we have to take that with a pinch of salt, too. So I thought that they were going to declare a victory, preliminary victory, for Karzai in the first round. It looks like maybe pressure and the fuss that Abdullah has put up has forced them to admit that they have to go to a second round, and then we'll see what happens. There are reports that there have been talks between Karzai, Abdullah, and the guy who was pegged to get into fourth place, that's Ashraf Ghani, who worked at the World Bank at one time, isn't particularly well known inside Afghanistan, as a matter of fact. there are behind-the-scenes negotiations with them, and a lot of Abdullah's bluster might be in order to ensure that his allies are strongly placed in the government and he's well-placed for the next time, because he's still a young man. He can afford to wait 5 years, quite frankly. If that is not the case, if a victory for Karzai is announced and it isn't credible to the Abdullah camp, we might see widespread protests. I spoke to Abdullah. I said, are you prepared to take this to the streets? I didn't say it literally in those words, but he said, I'm keeping things to legal. But he also said, if they don't give us a result which we believe is credible, they're putting us in a very difficult situation. So he could have, he could encourage his supporters to demonstrate. If he doesn't, even if he doesn't encourage them, they may be so worked up, some of them, that they may demonstrate. And in that case, in the situation in Afghanistan, things could get quite nasty. Don't let's forget that we're right next door to Iran. And at some point, some of Abdullah's supporters were comparing him to the losing candidate in the Iranian elections. I think that it won't go that far. I think there's enormous pressure, international pressure, on Abdullah and his supporters, notably the governor of Mazar-e-Sharif in the north, not to make too many waves. And I think that order will probably rule the day.
Well, I want to thank you, Tony Cross, very much for joining us today. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Tony Cross is a reporter for Radio France International's English language website, and you can read his reports at rfienglish.com. This is Uprising, and after today's subversive historian, we'll hear a special report from the campus of Cal State Northridge, and then finally, Food Fight, The Revolution Never Tasted So Good, a new documentary. Stay tuned.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on August 28, 1963, hundreds of thousands of people participated in the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. With organizational help from various civil rights groups, the planned demonstration faced disagreements from parties involved as to its stated objective. Some groups wanted to emphasize black poverty, while others wanted to show public support for the Kennedy administration's proposed civil rights legislation. When the march finally took place, John Lewis of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, for instance, had to tone down the criticisms he levied against President Kennedy. The demonstration would later on culminate that day on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech. The following year, the Civil Rights Act would be passed into law, due in part to that massive show of support for the civil rights movement during the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery. Why? They conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Facing an influx of angry and desperate students who could not add classes or were in standing room only classrooms, a coalition of faculty and students at Cal State Northridge recently organized a week-long faxing campaign called Vent at the Tent. The Vent Tent, which was up on the first day of school until yesterday, collected messages from over 1,000 students to be faxed to the offices of the governor, various lawmakers, and the CSU Board of Trustees. In addition to written messages, students and faculty shared their testimonies on video as well. During the last budget battle, the California educational system suffered a $9 billion cut, while the state prison system was cut by only $1.2 billion. As a result, CSU students received a 32% fee hike, classes were cut, professors were ordered to take furlough days, and for the first time in CSU history, eligible students were denied enrollment to the university. According to one estimate, about 10,000 eligible students were not accepted for the new semester, while admissions for the spring 2010 semester are already closed. The week-long Vent at the Tent on CSUN's campus was organized by the California Faculty Association and Students for Equality Education. Uprising intern and CSUN student Steve Gill spoke yesterday with several students and faculty and filed this special report from the event.
This department's having some trouble. I want to give you a couple of things to empower yourself, okay? Well, this is one step, and this does help, absolutely. We've collected, we'll probably have about 1,000 as of today. Okay, so you're not the only one. I know that's not going to help you get your classes, but it does help you understand the magnitude of the situation. You can also do some video testimony, because this video testimony is going to be compiled and sent to the governor, to the legislature, and to our president to really display how it's really affecting you as a human being.
I'm Teresa Montaño. I'm an associate professor of Chicana and Chicana Studies here at Cal State Northridge, and I'm also the California Faculty Association chapter president here at CSUN. Well, we have our event at the tent event this year. This is the first week of classes at Cal State Northridge, and we want to put a public face on the numbers of students who have been affected by the $584 million budget reduction at CSUN. Our students are not just numbers. It's not just 40,000 random people who have been thrown out of the system. Many of our students' parents have worked hard to make sure that they get a college education. And the first week of school, they're not getting into classes. Their classes are overcrowded. Their financial aid has been delayed. It is not business as usual. And I think that California needs to know what's happening to its public higher education system.
I'm Professor Michael Hogan. I'm an associate professor in the Cinema and Television Arts Department. I teach filmmaking production. Now, we are recording the stories of students who've been affected by our current situation here at CSUN, you know, the furlough impact and the elimination of classes and the elimination in some cases of financial support. And we're just simply recording the stories of those situations and those people. We're going to collect all of them and send them to Schwarzenegger.
Has this budget cuts personally affected you?
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell us how?
I may lose my house. So unless the bank will renegotiate with me, I'm in a bit of a fix.
We've had three students so far come to the tent and tell us that they've gone to a number of classes to try to get in, and if they're not able to get their classes, they face deportation. So it's not just a question of, if I don't get this class, I can go out and do, you know, get a job somewhere. They don't get these classes, they get deported. I've had teachers come in and say to me, I really need this class. If I don't get this class, I lose my job because I have to have a certain number of units in order to keep my position.
These students have to work even harder to come up with money. Like, last minute they sprung up on us that we had to pay $336 more. $336 is a lot. I don't even make that in a week. Like, for many students, you know, they had to hustle to get that money. And it's really sad to see students, like, having to worry so much about having to come up with this money, right? They call it fee hikes because it was free before, right? Fee hikes, fee increases.
Danny Santana.
Okay, and what exactly are you doing here?
Doing here to help get students, you know, to fill out these complaint forms, you know, if they couldn't get their classes, you know, because, I mean, it's not just about that they couldn't get their classes, but it's because they also, the Board of Trustees of the Cal States, they passed a 32% tuition fee hike this summer. A lot of students didn't know about that, so students are coming back. Some got dropped from their classes not knowing what's up, and some students who just don't have the resources to, you know, to pull that money together. And, you know, me personally, like, you know, I know it's serious because, you know, like, the Cal State is known as, like, the People's University because, you know, there's so many students of color that come into it. So, you know, that means, like, you know, I see, like, it's not just students of color, but, you know, it's all pretty much all students, you know. I mean, this class thing is getting, like, really crazy. You know, I was trying to add yesterday my history class, and there was over 30 students in that class trying to add. Luckily, I got in, but I don't know about what's up with the other students. You know, we're standing up, sitting in class, like, you know, just to get the lecture, and I don't know, that's pretty much why I'm here, you know, just kind of, like, spread word, and, like, you know, so, like, students are, like, they pretty much have something to do.
I mean, there's stories that are horrendous. One student went to 14 classes and tried to add all 14, couldn't get in to one of them. And as professors, you know, I have never turned down a student. As long as I had a seat, I would take that student in my class. Last night, I had to take five students and tell them they couldn't come in. I said to them, you know, whoever has the most heart-wrenching story, I'll let you in. I went outside. All of them had heart-wrenching stories. I couldn't make a decision. I had to draw their name out of a hat in order to add one student and the other four. All I could say to them is, you know, I'll beg, borrow, and steal to see if there's a way to get you in. I don't want to turn you down, but I have to.
I actually have to commute from the city of Linwood, from South Central all the way to here to Northridge. Yeah, I took all the other buses, the green line, the blue line, the red line, and then the orange line, and then a bus to get over here to campus. And so it's a 3-hour bus ride over here, then a 3-hour bus ride to go back home. And on top of that, I mean, I have to help pay rent at home, you know, because, I mean, and then even then, it's expensive to live out here. So, you know, it's a lot cheaper to just live at home. So that's why I haven't really, like, lived here. And I don't get a lot of financial aid. I'm working 2 jobs right now. I work in the weekends on the swap meet, too. And so, like, it's crazy for me.
Yeah, my name is Abraham Ramirez. I'm a transfer student. I just started. This is my second year here at Cal State Northridge. I'm the current chair for Mecha de Season, which is a student organization that has been around since 1969.
Have you filled out one of the complaint forms that are going to be faxed to all the decision makers in Sacramento?
Yeah, actually, I did file one of those. I think it was through Students for Quality Education.
Why was it so important for you to do that?
The main reason, I mean, you know, being that we're in this educational crisis, it's important for us to really show that, you know, we care, because a lot of times, politicians and people just make decisions without really consulting, you know, the people, or in this case, the students. So, I mean, if we don't, you know, stand up and really voice our opinion and make this issue heard, then they're going to just continue to think that we don't care about it, and they're going to continue to do what they want.
Do you know of any instances in which members of your club or you yourself have been personally affected by these budget cuts?
Yeah, actually, my girlfriend, she wasn't able to pay her tuition because of the hikes last semester. And what actually had to happen was that she had to borrow, you know, money from a lot of different people within Mecha and outside of it, from her family as well. So, I mean, you know, that only makes it, these hikes only make it more difficult for people to continue on their educational path. And instead of investing in education, they're only making it more difficult. I have a few friends who also were not able to attend this semester because of the increase. They had to, you know, take a semester off, which only means that their graduation is going to be postponed, and it's going to, you know, take us longer to get into the workforce. To be able to become, you know, professors and professionals.
My name is Brandy Mendoza. I'm an associate professor at the Gender and Women's Studies Program. We really have a horrific situation here. As you know, students have received a 32% fee hike, and faculty has a 10% wage cut. In reality, a 30% wage cut for those of us who have been here the last 10 years, because we haven't received the raises we are supposed to be receiving. So we are a severely underpaid faculty. This is a mistreated student body, too. So what we have here is that we have to reduce 9 days of our semester, 9 furlough days. And the procedure has been that they have given us, they say, the freedom to determine which days we are supposed to be taking. And they gave us a little sheet there where you write down your furlough days. They were but not approved. Mine were not approved. I teach 4 days a week. I teach 4 courses. And I think they want me to take furlough days on Saturday because... tell me, when you teach 4 times a week, when do you take your furlough days? Because it was not approved because they're telling me that I took them on teaching days. And I teach 4 times a week, so that's what's happening here at CSUN. You get the impression that they just want to pay you less and continue business as usual. You know, I think that the assault against higher education and the assault against public education is so grave right now that we need to take more action. I just learned today, for instance, that apparently also CSUN is opening a program, a national security program. There's, you know, so to open careers so that students join careers, you know, for intelligence. That's something that is very new to me. I assume that it's because they're getting money from the Pentagon. So that's what happens when we don't have any funds. We take money from anybody. And we are very worried. I am very concerned that if that is true, that is actually happening in our campus and in the college we belong to. I'm a gender and women's studies professor. We work for social justice and peace. And I think students deserve something much better than what they're getting. And faculty, too. I think we're people, too. We also have to pay our bills. Well, I have a personal story, and also my students. I'll begin with my students. I went around the first day of class asking them how they were affected by the budget crisis, and I'll just tell you it's really a horror story, one after the other. All students will tell you that or they are themselves laid off, or their parents are laid off, or their siblings are laid off. They have no health insurance. They are deeply in debt. They can't find their classes. Their scheduling is really messed up for them this semester. They have to spend more on gas. They were told that a $700 increase, it was given on them with very short notice. Some of them are not able to really bring up that money, et cetera. As for my own personal story, too, I cannot pay my bills anymore. I also have a 23-year-old daughter whose health insurance runs out when you turn 23. She has a precondition, so I have to pay $500 a month now for her insurance. She's unemployed, and I have a wage cut, which means that I, as a faculty, as a professor, PhD from an Ivy League institution, I cannot afford food because after I paid my bills, I don't have anything left over. So, I share the same stories with my students. You know, we are really deeply affected by this crisis.
And how do you see the future of California and the California State University system if these budget cuts continue?
Well, what I see is a dismantling from public education. That I've been seeing this and following it for a long time, but this is a very aggressive move that has been done to really dismantle public education. The CSU will not be able to continue with these furloughs. I hear that it will not only be this year, but we should expect at least another year of the same. That's enough to really liquidate what there is left of public education. And as for the future of California, everybody knows that a economy with uneducated labor force is programmed for failure. And this economy is already a failure. We know that, but then we have no future. And we are sacrificing a whole generation that is supposed to take over the economy, and it will not be prepared. And we also know that education is not only to get a job and, become a little piece in the economy. We educate people to become citizens in a democracy and to become conscientious beings. And we are not given, we don't even have the time for that anymore. We are all really in economic and social despair, faculty and students. So we should unite. We're all in the same boat here.
Hey, can you tell me your name and your position again?
My name is Brandy Mendoza. I am an associate professor of gender and women's studies.
Thank you.
And I also come from Honduras, where we just had a coup, and I tell my students, I saw millions of dollars pouring in my country to support a military civilian regime. Bring those billions of dollars to California. Hondurans will be very thankful.
If it's okay for us to contact you about more student activities, please check the box at the bottom. That way you'll stay informed. If something's happening and it can make a difference, we can contact you.
Well, I don't know if y'all ever read the Master Plan of Higher Education. Originally, the Cal State was free. That's why they don't call it tuition. It's called fees, right? So they're pretty much increasing your fees, right, not tuition. So you can't really say, it's not correct to say tuition hikes. Another thing that y'all should know about, if you're wondering what the bottom box is, if you're interested in getting involved, not just like, just filling out this stuff, but, actually organizing action, stuff like this. Like right here, we're working with the professors and whatnot too. Like, we're filling these out, but this is us too. So if y'all are interested in getting connected, you could check the little box at the bottom and we'll hit you back up. And, if y'all haven't heard of us, we're SQE. You can email us at csun.sqe@gmail.com if you want more info. Or if you just see us around campus, just hit us up and we'll be around.
Those are the voices of students and faculty of Cal State Northridge over a special week-long campaign called Vent at the Tent that took place on that campus about the effects of budget cuts on everyone, students and faculty alike. Special thanks to Uprising intern and CSUN student Steve Gill for filing this report. This is Uprising, and after this short break, Food Fight, the revolution never tasted so good.
Tune in Sunday, August 30th at 9 a.m. to Politics or Pedagogy. As the school year starts, 164 Los Angeles teachers are in limbo. As LAUSD locked them up and thrown away the key, members of the UTLA Reassignment Task Force, former school board member David Tikosky, Mimi Kennedy, and Jeff Levy, one of Squeaky Fromm's attorneys, will take your calls. Politics or Pedagogy, 9 a.m. Sunday, August 30th.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. An op-ed this morning in the conservative Wall Street Journal takes a different tack on the debate over health care. The U.S. Secretary of Commerce, Gary Locke, argued that fixing health care is good for business and that the real horror story is not what health care reform will bring, it's what's already happening. Part of the health care crisis that is getting very little coverage in the media is the link between increasingly poor health, particularly among low-income Americans, and the effects of an over-industrialized food system. Starvation and obesity are two sides of the same coin, and that applies to rich countries like the U.S. as well, as a result of profit-driven fast food. Today, KPFK is exploring the healthcare debate from an alternative angle, focusing on food security and sovereignty, local farming, and the politics of food. The history of how our food got to be dominated by a highly processed so-called convenience foods filled with high fructose corn syrup and soy-based oil goes all the way back to the World War II, as illustrated in a new documentary, Food Fight, Revolution Never Tasted So Good. The film by Chris Taylor and Alan Siegel follows what they call a revolution of fresh, organic, local, and most of all, great-tasting food as embodied by growing numbers of farmers markets. On this last day of August fundraising, during which we've kept programming as intact as possible, we're asking you to dig deep into your pockets and make a contribution to keep KPFK going. You'll hear all sorts of coverage of the healthcare reform debate and health in general on the station today. And if you pledge $10 a month this hour, we'll send you a copy of the DVD Food Fight, The Revolution Never Tasted So Good. It's a very important documentary that talks about the healthcare debate from a different angle than what you hear in the mainstream media. And as you may have heard this day already and on previous days during the fund drive, we have not made our budget goal from June, and also we've had poor fulfillment rates because, of course, the economy has affected all of us. And right here at KPFK, it's no exception. We're going to play you an excerpt of Food Fight, the opening minutes of this very important documentary, but we encourage all of you who are listening to call us at 818-985-5735 and pledge $10 a month to KPFK to keep Uprising and all the other programs on the air. 818-985-KPFK. Here's Food Fight.
The industrial food system is not doing what a food system needs to do, which is not just produce lots of food, but to keep a population healthy. The industrial food system is making us very sick in many, many different ways. There is the obesity epidemic. There is diabetes. 4 out of 10 leading killers in this country are food-related chronic diseases.
I'm really worried about what's going to happen in this country if we don't sort of wake up and understand the consequences of every decision that we make about everything that we eat every day.
There's a big problem with food in our country today. Large commodity producers and large agribusinesses have hijacked and taken over the farm subsidy programs, and it's resulting in production of food types that aren't healthy for us Americans.
Our government food policy promotes eating junk food. It really does. The rewards go to the people who make junk food. So in a sense, our current food system promotes obesity.
One of the most remarkable things, I think, about this rise of industrial food in the second half of the 20th century is that it's been underwritten by taxpayer dollars.
If you listen to debates, there's never anything about the food system. It takes people like us, the sustainable food people, to bring up that stuff. And when we go and we get involved in the policy piece of the farm bill. It's like we're going up against Goliath, and we really lose almost every time.
American food policy, starting really in the teens and into the 20s, was to supply people with the most amount of food at the lowest price.
How does food policy fit into the healthcare debate? That is the question that you will get answered when you watch this important documentary, Food Fight, The Revolution Never Tasted So Good. We're featuring it in the last 15 minutes of this program, trying to carve out as little space as possible on the show to ask for your support to KPFK at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. It's a pledge of $10 a month to support KPFK, and we'll send you a copy of Food Fight, The Revolution Never Tasted So Good, an important documentary that covers the food commodities markets of corn and soy, the origins of our industrialized food systems, but then also looks at the solutions, the proliferation of farmers' markets. And, you know, much of that is a California story, the local food and the slow food movements, the connections between the 60s peace movements and the food revolutions, as well as school lunches, obesity and diabetes, food for those in inner cities and those living in cold climates in the U.S., and the poor taste and nutritional quality of industrialized food. It even looks at the layout of supermarkets. There's a lot of vintage footage, there's some animation, and it features best-selling author Michael Pollan, who wrote Omnivore's Dilemma, and of course his latest book, In Defense of Food, as well as Congressman Ron Kind, celebrity chef Wolfgang Puck, Alice Waters, founder of a Berkeley restaurant called Chez Panisse, which serves only fresh foods found locally. 818-985-KPFK is the phone number to call, 818-985-5735. We have 12 minutes at the end of this hour to ask for your support in making a pledge to KPFK. And it's very important that we get your support in our 50th year this year. It's a vulnerable year for all of us here at the station as well. Thank you very much for that call. And if you appreciated the coverage that you hear on this program every single day, you know, we have a host of interns that are working with us that we train. You just heard this fantastic piece by Steve Gill. It was his first report, first time going out and doing a field recording. We set him up with a recorder. We trained him. He came back to the station, and we used his sound. We helped him edit it and presented it to you, bringing the voices of our community onto the airwaves directly. That's the role that KPFK plays, empowering students like Steve and our other interns. A couple of weeks ago, you heard our intern Natalie Yar bring you a report from the Inglewood Healthcare Forum, and we're going to be doing much more of that as the months continue, but we need your support to keep the station going. Thank you so much for that call. A pledge of $10 a month to KPFK will get you the satisfaction of knowing that you've helped keep your community station around, and we'll give you a copy of Food Fight, the DVD. In studio with me, Interim Program Director Alan Minsky and my frequent co-host when we fundraise here. Alan?
Good morning, Sonali. And the number here to call is 818-985-5735. KPFK is in its 50th year now. I suppose we've entered the 51st year if you sort of add it up inclusively. So we've passed the day that was our 50th birthday back on July 26th. And we need to keep KPFK strong. And, of course, we're in the midst of a global economic recession. We've done well during the fund drive, but between people having, their credit cards are on hold and people just recognizing the financial problems that they're in, we have about $600,000 of money that was pledged to the station that hasn't come in yet. And consequently, in order to keep the station strong, to keep it going for another 50 years, the unique community radio station of Southern California, we do need your support. We want to thank you very much for the person who just called. And for $10 a month for an annual membership to KPFK, we will send you as a thank you gift this hour the movie Food Fight. And again, South Pasadena Farmers Market, represent.
I was just there yesterday. 818-985-5735 is the phone number to call. 818-985-KPFK. I want to play you another excerpt from this documentary, which goes into the history of our industrialized food system and how, you know, it really helps you sort of understand why food is the way it is here in the United States today. When you go into supermarkets, into conventional supermarkets, and you see how supermarkets are laid out, why so much of the ingredients in our food is based on corn and soy and filler rather than on just pure basic food. And, of course, those are issues that are part of our healthcare debate but often don't get mentioned. 818-985-KPFK is the phone number. Here's Food Fight. The revolution never tasted so good.
Government got us out of the frying pan and into the deep fryer. Now our grocery stores are packed with a bunch of junk. Luckily for us, there were a few passionate people who remembered what good, healthy food was supposed to taste like. But the battle lines for this food fight were drawn in an earlier conflict. Actually, it was kind of a big one. With the outbreak of World War II, food wasn't just food. It was national defense.
Among those called to the armed forces, we discovered an appalling number of young men who were undernourished or improperly fed, and not up the standard of physical fitness essential to a hard-fighting army. 400,000 were rejected, many because of physical unfitness due to malnutrition.
War and agriculture have all sorts of connections. They have since World War II.
As the saying goes, an army marches on its stomach. So, the army spent tons of money figuring out how to get food to soldiers fighting overseas. They came up with some nifty ideas. Dehydration, flash freezing, and lightweight packaging. Portability was the top priority. Taste? Not so much.
This necessity to get calories to soldiers to keep them fighting in the field turns into this ability to market processed food to average working people.
Enter the K-ration, grandfather to the modern TV dinner.
These war foods are also bulwarks against famine and catastrophe. To produce them, we have a new industry. This company intends to make K a packaged meal business when peace comes.
Thanks to the war, we also learned how to make bigger and better bombs, and it turned out the same chemistry could be used to make bigger and better fertilizers. You see, plants need nitrogen to grow, and we'd never found a good way to get it to them. But with the new artificial fertilizers, we could give plants all the nitrogen they could want, and big agriculture exploded. There was one other giant industry feeding the agriculture boom.
As it has in the past, America's oil industry will continue to supply power for the farmer to accomplish a job that's now worldwide in scope.
The industrialization of food in America wouldn't have been possible without the big oil companies. And the petroleum industry quickly became one of the current system's biggest beneficiaries. The way we farm now, petroleum is in just about everything.
And that's another short excerpt from the documentary Food Fight. The Revolution Never Tasted So Good, a very, very important documentary, very well reviewed. It premiered at the AFI Film Festival and won a number of awards, including Best In-Show Documentary at the Indie Fest, Best Documentary at the HD Fest in Los Angeles, won the Audience Award at the 2008 International Documentary Association, and a very important documentary that we're featuring today as part of our tiny little minimalist fundraising drive. It's the last day in August, so my last chance to ask you this. We had four fundraising days in August to try to make up for our budget shortfall. And, you know, we don't want to continuously fundraise, so we didn't spend the entire show doing that. We brought you the news. We brought you the news of what's happening in Afghanistan. So important as the U.S. military occupation there increases and gets more and more dangerous. We brought you that report as we've been doing over the last several weeks and months. We brought you the report of what's happening on the campus of Cal State Northridge. Now we're asking you in these last few minutes of the show for your help. Those of you who've never pledged before, there's many of you who pledge repeatedly, and boy, you are the most incredible, dedicated, loyal listeners I think any public radio station is lucky to have, and we're honored to have you. But those of you who've never pledged before, pledge $10 a month, and we'll send you a copy of this documentary, Food Fight, The Revolution Never Tasted So Good, a very powerful documentary that not only exposes the downside of the industrialized food system, but then explores the solutions that are already in place, that are already proliferating, especially here in California, with the rise of farmers markets and the local food movements, and how people are realizing that the taste of food is directly linked to the nutrition in food, which is directly linked to our health. 818-985-5735 is a phone number to call, 818-985-KPFK. And the healthcare reform coverage that you've been getting on this station, I challenge you to find better coverage on any radio station in Los Angeles. In terms of the other side of that debate, the single-payer advocates that are getting, that are interviewed on KPFK, by far greater numbers than any other media institution on the airwaves. And the majority of Americans, poll after poll, have shown support government insurance option. And we represent you, the people. 818-985-KPFK is the phone number to call. If we have time, I want to play a short excerpt of the healthcare forum report that I did at Alhambra. Very interesting exchange I had with one conservative protester who was present there. But we don't have much time left, folks. We have a few callers on the line right now. Pledge $10 a month to KPFK for Food Fight. The revolution never tasted so good. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK.
Yes, it's just a pledge of $10 a month. That's a little less than 33 cents a day to support KPFK. And we will send you a thank you gift, the movie Food Fight, and by calling 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Become a member of KPFK, renew your membership, and for $10 a month, we'll send you as a thank you gift this very insightful film about really one of the most important things that can be done on an individual basis to build a healthier society, which is to support organic, freshly raised food that tastes good, that tastes better, isn't fast, isn't processed.
And it's not just on an individual basis. These are people are getting organized over this, and that's what's amazing about it. 818-985-KPFK. I want to play you an excerpt of the report that I did at the Alhambra Healthcare Forum run by Congressman Adam Schiff as an example of the kind of coverage that KPFK has been bringing you. Keep calling.
Excuse me, sir. What do you mean by your sign that I pay for mine, you pay for yours? What are you referring to?
If you want a house, if you want health care, if you want a car, you pay for it. If I want a house, if I want a car, if I want health care, I pay for it.
What about police protection?
What?
What about, say, the police department or the fire department?
Oh, we all pay for that. We all pay for that. Same with national security, the military. Absolutely.
But not health care?
No, absolutely not.
What's the difference?
818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. This was the interview that I was accused of being a socialist because I questioned the logic of this conservative protester. 818-985-5735 is the number to call if you appreciate this kind of programming. We urge you to call and support KPFK. We just have a minute left, folks. It's a pledge of just $10 a month for Food Fight. The revolution never tasted so good. And the documentary is very important. Keeping KPFK alive is very important. Keeping yourself alive and healthy is very important. We can't do it without one another stepping up to support each other and to support ourselves. KPFK tries to support you and tries to bring your voice to the airwaves every single day. Won't you come forward and help us right now? 818-985-5735. Thank you so much for that call. Join the callers that have already called by making a pledge at 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Adele Davis once said, "We are indeed much more than what we eat, but what we eat can nevertheless help us to be much more than what we are." That's Adele Davis, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. Alan Minsky, thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali. And the number again is 818-985-5735. $10 a month over a year-long membership, and we'll send you as a thank you gift the DVD of the film Food Fight.
You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Steve Gill and Daniel Cooper are our interns. Melissa Figueroa is our engineer. Our website is kpfk.org/uprising. You can also pledge online at kpfk.org anytime this hour. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Golhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. Keep those calls coming. See you on Monday at 8.